he's a little uncomfortable at how his being part of the company could be perceived by people who don't know us. It does look a little like a harem. I don't press, though. He's a genuinely good man, and he's uncomfortable for our sake more than his. There's not really a way to talk him out of that one.
Does your mother know about that?
Sterling asks, pointing to the tattoo that stretches along Priya's entire left side.
Helped me pick the parlor and went with me to every session, the girl says with a laugh.
At the beginning of summer, she kept slipping into French whenever she wasn't directly addressing one of us, her brain hardwired from 3 years of living in Paris. She hasn't done it in a couple of weeks, though. I lean over in the chair so I can see it better. I knew she was working on it over the spring months, but she didn't tell us what she was getting. Last time she was down here, at the beginning of the summer, the final session was still healing, so she didn't show us. If the size of it is somewhat surprising, the images are absolutely Priya. A large chess queen, made of colorful stained glass, stands in a base of flowers. Jonquils, calla lilies, freesia, all the flowers left by the serial killer who murdered her sister and then hunted Priya. Chavi's flowers, sunshine yellow chrysanthemums, ring the queen's crown. Above the chrysanthemums float two butterflies, large enough to make out their specific coloring. I don't have to look them up to know what they are. A western pine elfin and a Mexican blue wing, which can be found in more detail on Inara's and Victoria Bliss's backs, respectively.
I felt like I could finally leave it behind, Priya says quietly.
It? The sense of being a victim. Like, somehow it was all finally mine, and under my skin where it belonged, rather than shredding me. Without conscious thought, my fingers trace the scars on my cheek, covered with waterproof makeup. Priya's seen them bare, but I don't think Inara and Victoria Bliss ever have.
But then, even outside of the tattoos, they have their own scars.
Inara's hands will forever show the trials of the night the garden exploded, burns and bits of glass leaving their marks when she fought to keep the other butterflies safe in impossible circumstances. Priya's hands have thin, pale scars across her palms and fingers where she fought for possession of a knife, and a worse line across her neck, a blade held to her pulse. Scars mean we survived something, even when the wounds still hurt. The day offers a much-needed sense of relaxation, even after the heat chases us inside to the air conditioning. As night falls and the temperature starts dipping a little, we return to the patio with arms overflowing with s'mores fixings, because Sterling learned that Inara has never had a s'more. There isn't a fire pit in the complex, but shortening the legs on one of the grills places flames at a comfortable height, and Priya has her camera out to capture Inara's first bite. She closes her eyes like she's tasting heaven, a bit of melting chocolate clinging to the corner of her mouth, a blob of marshmallow sticking to her nose, and I can't wait to show that picture to Vic. Then my phone goes off. We all freeze, staring at it where it innocently sits on top of my shoes. None of us have mentioned the case today. Somehow there was just this sense of agreement to leave it alone for another day, maybe two, just later. Sterling leans over to read the screen.
It's Holmes, she says quietly.
I grab it and accept the call.
I don't care what Simpkins says, the detective says by way of hello. These kids are hysterical, and they need you here.
Which kids?
The three who wandered into the fire station half an hour ago with teddy bears and your name. Get to Prince William.
Once upon a time, there was a little girl who was scared of crying. It seemed she'd spent her whole life crying. Those few days in the hospital, after Daddy was arrested, whenever she cried, a nurse or social worker would hurry into the room if the angel wasn't already there. They'd comfort her with soft voices and gentle hugs, things she'd never known before. And she would feel stronger until the fear got the better of her again. Then it was off to that first foster home where only tears given to God had any meaning. She didn't know how to give her tears to God. She didn't know how to give anything to God. But that home didn't have children anymore, not since one of the boys passed out in class and a doctor discovered they were all being starved. They all got sent to different homes, and the little girl liked the second home. The woman was funny and kind, and the man had sad eyes and a gentle smile, and always seemed to know which one of the girls were the most broken, because he would speak softly to them, hands by his sides. He never touched them, never cornered them, was so careful to give them space, and never called them pet names. He never called her angel or baby, never called her beautiful. But then there was a car accident, and unlike Mama's, this one really was an accident, and another group of kids was scattered. The next house was all right, everyone fairly content to ignore each other outside of meals. But then the man's sister and children came to live with them, and the sister was sick. Too sick for the man and woman to take care of children who weren't theirs. That's when the little girl was sent here, to a woman who passed her days in a haze of pills and her nights with alcohol and sedatives, and never knew what her husband did to the children in their care. Daddy would have liked the husband. She cried because this wasn't supposed to happen again. She was never supposed to have to suffer through this again. Ever, the angel had said. She wasn't supposed to have gone through this ever. But the man came to her room and told her that she liked it. She knew she did. She knew she'd missed this, being taken care of properly. But she couldn't stop crying. She never could. 19.
Sterling, get the girls back to Vic's. Come on, Ramirez, we need to change.
Edison dumps the emergency bucket of sand over the grill, extinguishing the flames, and grabs up whatever packaging he can. After a moment, the rest of us pitch in, then jog up to his apartment. The girls grab bags and give me hugs or kisses as they follow Sterling out. It seems stupid to take time to change clothes, especially when we're not the ones working the case, but I can't well show up in shorts and a halter top. We yank on jeans, and Sterling tosses me a long-sleeved University of Miami tee to throw on over the halter top. We're out the door in less than 2 minutes after the girls, and actually pull out of the parking lot before they do. They wandered into a fire station, I tell him, hanging on to the oh shit handle for dear life. Edison doesn't dick around when he's driving to a scene. Three kids. They're being taken to Prince William.
Got it.
He curses at a red light, then, seeing no one coming down the cross street, runs it.
3 days, the time between kills is getting shorter and shorter.
The car screams into the hospital's parking lot just behind the ambulances, and then we're running to the ER entrance to follow the kids who are way too small for the gurneys they're on. The boys look like twins, so thin it's impossible to guess their age, and the girl doesn't look any better. Holmes is waiting at the nurse's station. She draws herself up to greet the children, but upon actually seeing them, her giant coffee slips from her nerveless fingers to splash all over the floor.
"Are they high?" she hisses.
One of the boys is shaking, not a seizure so much as a full body tremor, grinding his teeth as his head sways back and forth. He plucks and tears at the skin around his fingernails, leaving great bloody streaks behind, and he can't seem to stop talking, the words spilling out fast and half-formed. His twin is silent, but his pupils are blown so wide he can't possibly see anything, and his skin is bright with sweat. He keeps trying to swallow, but each time his dry throat clicks and catches, and he tries again. Their sister is screaming, stopping only long enough to draw another ragged breath, and her arms are belted to the gurney, I assume to keep her from adding to the scratches all down her arms. She's absolutely hysterical, pupils blown and eyes unfocused.
"They've been exposed to meth," I say breathlessly. "A lot of meth to have this kind of effect."
The nurses jump into action, the charge nurses snapping instructions and sending one of them running for doctors.
"How much do you think to get that?" Holmes asks.
"Their parents have to be cooking it." Jesus, my hands are shaking. I've seen kids under the influence before, but never to that extent. Usually when someone's drugging a child, it's to subdue them, not hop them up.
"Has anyone made it out to the parents yet?"
"The closer fire station," she answers grimly.
"The house is on fire?"
Edison curses under his breath.
"Meth kitchens explode pretty frequently, but I'm going to guess this one had help. If the parents were inside..."
Explains why the only blood on the children is what they've drawn themselves.
"Mignone is out at the scene. We called Simpkins. She and some of her agents are heading out. But the girl, Zoe, she kept chanting your name. Can you?"
"Yes." Leaving Edison and Holmes mopping up spilled coffee, I head behind the girl's curtain. "Zoe," Holmes said. She's fighting the nurses as they unstrap her, her bony arms flailing as she continues to scream.
"Zoe? Zoe, can you hear me?"
If she does, she's too worked up to answer. "Zoe, my name is Mercedes. Mercedes Ramirez." The screams stop, at least, and she stares at me, or tries to, her shoulders heaving with labored, gasping breaths.
"Mercedes. Mercedes. Safe, Mercedes. She said that."
The charge nurse frees a hand to point at a spot on the bed. Obediently, I sit there, pulling on the gloves she tossed me, and when they transfer Zoe to the bed, I'm at the perfect position to take her hands in mine, gently, but too firmly for her to pull and scratch. Around the long, frenzied scratches, bright rashes bloom up and down her arms.
"That's right, Zoe," I say softly. "You're safe now. You're at the hospital. Your brothers are here. We're going to help you. You're safe here."
The shuddering gasps turn into sobs, and she collapses forward, letting me cradle her against my chest. I carefully prop my shoulder under her cheek, keeping her face away from the exposed skin at my neck. I don't want to get an accidental contact high from the meth on her skin and clothes.
"We've got you," I murmur, holding her steady for the nurses.
They work quickly,
getting her vitals settled and an IV started for fluids. With a bit of coaching, Zoe turns her arm to let them draw blood. Meth is a given, but they'll need to check to make sure that's all it is.
My brothers,
she chokes out. They're here, Zoe. It's okay. They're getting help, too. They're just on the other side of those curtains. She's starting to wheeze, and I rub a gloved hand in circles against her back to try to settle her a bit.
The lady, she grabbed the lady.
She flaps her hand hard enough to almost dislodge the second draw needle at her elbow. There are red impressions around her wrist, darker than the rash.
Fingers? The beginning of bruises?
She grabbed your arm, didn't she, Zoe? Kept hold of you so your brothers wouldn't fight? Nodding, she draws in a deeper breath. It's still shaky, but it's stronger, followed by another good breath.
An angel, Mercy. She didn't have wings.
Zoe, were you and your brothers trying to sleep when she came in?
Sleeping. Trying, but our skin was alive.
She looks down at her arms and tries to pull her hands away to scratch. One of the nurses holds her IV arm still, and I keep the other one against Zoe's thigh. When did your skin come alive? Zoe, when did it start?
We wanted dinner. The beds were out of food. Mommy and Daddy made us dinner. We never eat in the kitchen. We ate in the kitchen, though, with Mommy and Daddy.
Cagaste y saltaste en la caca, Jesucristo. Those idiots weren't cooking meth in a shed or garage. They were using their own fucking kitchen.
The beds were out of food? Did the kids hide food in their rooms so they wouldn't have to go to the kitchen?
Santa Madre de Dios.
You had dinner. You were trying to sleep. Zoe, what happened then? Zoe?
An angel came.
Her words are softer, her voice cracked and raw from screaming.
Angels have wings. Didn't have wings.
What did the angel do, Zoe?
She...
With a sudden gasp, she starts seizing. The nurses grab her out of my arms and lower her to the bed, supporting her head and neck against the spasms. One of them eyes his watch, timing the fit. How long? Snaps a young doctor, pushing through the curtain. 42 seconds, answers the one with the watch. They push an injection into her IV, close to her hand, but it still takes a couple of minutes for the seizure to ease. Once she falls limp, they loop an oxygen mask over her face. I'm sorry, Agent, I need you out of here, the doctor says. And to her credit, she does actually look sorry. Of course. Her brothers? Not seizing. You can try. I peel off the gloves and get a fresh pair, just in case, and head to the next set of curtains. The quiet one is there, his hands shaking finally as he gulps down water under the watchful eye of a nurse. When the cup's empty, he tries to hand it back to her, but can only hold it out vaguely in her direction. She pours in a little more from a pitcher and gives it back to him. He's already got a self-adhering bandage looped over his elbow from a blood draw, the IV taped to the back of his hand. Because they didn't have to struggle with him the way they did with Zoe, he's also got heart monitor pads on his chest, and an oxygen mask is sitting on the bed by his hip.
Dry mouth, the nurse informs me quietly. There's only so much the water can help right now, but we'll get the mask on him in a couple of minutes.
I give her a quick smile and look back at the boy.
My name is Mercedes, I tell him, and he nods, seeming to recognize it.
Can you tell me your name?
Brayden, he rasps.
Okay, Brayden. How old are you?
9. Caleb, 2. Zoe's 8.
He blinks rapidly, but his eyes won't focus.
Is Zoe okay?
None of you are okay right now, I answer honestly, my hands curling around the foot of the bed. You're getting help, though, and right now, that's what's important.
They sounded scared.
She had a seizure. The nurse looks startled and opens her mouth like she's about to cut me off, but subsides. They gave her something to calm the seizure, and they're going to run tests so they know how else to help her.
But she's gonna be okay.
I don't know, Brayden, but the doctors are doing their absolute best, I promise.
Mom and Dad didn't get out of the house, he tells me. They were still sleeping. She had Zoe, and she pushed us out of the house, and it exploded. She said it was the way it needed to be.
Did she say why?
She said you were going to keep us safe.
Brayden, do you remember anything about the lady?
She was an angel.
He frowns, draining the rest of his cup.
She looked like an angel, maybe.
Maybe?
I don't see too good. But she looked all white, like the moon.
Did she give you anything? I ask, already knowing the answer, but curious how he'll answer it.
Bears, he replies promptly. White bears, and parts of them were noisy.
Noisy like what?
Like bubble wrap blankets, he decides after some thought. Like a tissue paper present.
Were you in a car, Brayden? With the nurse watching his vitals and giving him just a little bit of water each time he empties the cup, I ask Brayden all the questions I can think of until a doctor comes in, and then I move down to the next curtain. I don't swap out the gloves this time because I didn't touch Brayden. Caleb, however, is in no condition to be answering questions. He doesn't seem to hear what the nurses and doctors are asking him. Beneath the oxygen mask, he keeps up a steady stream of half-formed words and occasionally cocks his swaying head as if he's listening to something, but what he's saying doesn't seem to have anything to do with what the rest of us hear. So I peek back behind Zoe's curtain. They've got her hooked up to a heart monitor now, and it's going a little crazy, so I don't try to go in. Instead, I walk back to the nurse's station. Edison is there, but Holmes isn't.
She went outside to meet Simpkins,
he answers, before I can ask the question.
Mierda. She specifically wanted you here, and it calmed the girl.
Yeah, calmed her right into a seizure. He flicks the center of my forehead, more irritating than painful.
One has nothing to do with the other. Stop.
Extrapolating from what Brayden said, I sigh, peeling off the UMT so I can lean against the counter without worrying about cast-off meth from Zoe. Our killer prepared the explosion before she woke up the kids. She woke up Zoe first and kept hands on her so the boys wouldn't risk fighting, if they were in any condition to do so. Parents were still sleeping in their room. She pushed the boys outside, did something, then carried Zoe out and got all three kids a safe distance away before the explosion. Brayden said he felt the heat, but they weren't in danger of burning. She got them into the car, a big car, he said, keeping Zoe in the front seat,
and gave them the bears. Braden tried to open the door, but the child lock must have been engaged. He doesn't know how long they drove for. She stopped in front of the fire station to let them out and gave them the instructions and my name. He looked back when they were at the station door, but he couldn't see well enough to know if she was still there. One of the firefighters ran out and looked, but didn't see any cars out of place, so she must have gone. Being in the halter top has made me anxious, especially knowing Simpkins is right outside, but I'd really prefer not to wear the meth-rubbed shirt any longer than I absolutely have to. "He's seizing," calls a voice from Caleb's curtain. A moment later, a similar cry rises from Zoe's partition. Edison grabs my arm before I can race back to Braden's bed. "Doctor is in with him," he says softly. "I know you want to comfort him, but right now you'll be in the way, especially with the other two in such unstable condition." "Why do you think he isn't as bad as them?" "We don't know that he isn't, just that he isn't seizing yet." "Ramirez, what the hell are you wearing?" snaps Simpkins, stalking inside with Holmes at her heels. The two Smiths, who have been on her team about as long as she's willing to keep anyone, follow, giving us small nods of acknowledgement. I stand straight up and point to the bundle of fabric on the counter. "It has meth cast off from calming the girl," I answer calmly. "It wasn't safe to wear, and we didn't have time to change before we came."
"You shouldn't have come here at all."
"It was my call," Holmes reminds her in an aggrieved tone. "Clearly, the children don't need you now," Simpkins continues, ignoring the interruption.
"Leave."
"No," retorts Holmes. "I called her in."
"You chose to partner with the FBI.
"Partnered? Yes. I did not give up the case to you, and I need her checking on these kids." The two women stare each other down, and honestly, I'm very glad I get to stand off to one side for this particular pissing match. Surprisingly, Simpkins is the one to look away.
"Who can give me a status report?" she yells, stomping toward the curtains, and two nurses and a doctor glare at her.
The taller Smith shrugs out of his windbreaker and holds it out to me, while the stouter Smith pulls a plastic sack from the bag at his side. I drop the shirt into the sack, following it with the gloves, and then gratefully accept the jacket. It's cold, true. Hospitals are nearly always cold, but I feel more exposed than I'd like, in a way that doesn't really have anything to do with clothing or skin. The jacket helps anyway.
"We'll be in the waiting room," Edison tells Holmes and the Smiths. "They don't need any more people in those cubbies right now."
"We'll send someone," the taller Smith promises. "They've been partnered up for 13 years, 6 of them on Simpkins's team, but I have never heard the Smiths referred to as anything but a cohesive unit. I honestly do not even know their first names, because they are always, always, the Smiths." The waiting room is nearly empty. In one corner, a sobbing woman rocks back and forth in an uncomfortable chair, her fingers moving along her rosary. In her other hand, she clutches a passport and a work visa. Edison drops into the chair beside me, taking my hand to lace our fingers together, and I lean against his shoulder.
"Have you updated Vic and Sterling?" I mumble.
"Yeah. I'll send another in a minute." My eyes are burning, and I want to say it's just from cast-off somehow, but it's exhaustion and rage and fear and the twisting claw in my gut, wondering if we're actually going to catch this person
and what kind of reaction the community will have if it happens. In the same breath that people abhor those who break the law, they also love vigilantes with an appealing cause. Rescuing children from abuse? The public will eat that up when it comes out. So far, the papers have been quiet about the details. The murders have happened in different parts of town, or even outside of it, but still in county, so no one's drawn big blinking lights around them to connect them. And, too, the editor down at the main paper is usually good about squashing stories that exploit kids as victims. I want to go home. I'm not sure home is home anymore. 20. Zoe Jones dies at 2:13 in the morning when a series of hyperthermic seizures causes a massive stroke. Caleb Jones dies 3 hours later of rapid organ failure, including his heart. Braden's doctor tells us that the boy is physically stable for now, though they'll be monitoring him closely as he starts into withdrawal symptoms. Emotionally, Braden isn't talking to anyone. Not to me, not to Simpkins or Holmes, not to any of the doctors or nurses. He cries when they tell him about Zoe, but when they have to come back and tell him about his twin, he just shuts down. Tate, the social worker who'd been with Mason on Wednesday, shows up around 6 and listens gravely as we fill him in.
It took me longer to get here because I stopped to get their case file, he explains, holding up the folder. A home inspection was done 4 months ago based on an anonymous complaint, likely from their previous neighbors, but they had just moved into the house, everything was still clean. When we interviewed the children, Zoe and Caleb said they played outside most of the time. Braden stayed in the house more. Presumably, he was the one who would go into the kitchen to get supplies if they ran out of food. They had a mini-fridge in the boys' room, tubs of food under the bed they said were snacks. I think if they ran out, Braden was the only one to go into the kitchen. He built up a slight tolerance, so he didn't overdose as badly last night, I translate, and he nods. But yesterday their parents broke the pattern. They made dinner for the kids and sat down together to eat in the kitchen. The other two were exposed in greater quantity than they're used to, and even Braden was probably in there longer than usual.
We requested a drug test on the children following the inspection, but it was rejected because the house was clean.
What about a drug test on the parents? Edison asks.
House was clean, Tate repeats. We don't think the Joneses were purposeful users. Our theory was that they rode the contact high from cooking it and sold it for income. They didn't demonstrate the more overt symptoms of tweakers. Their prior residence had already been sold, so we were refused permission to test there.
And so the kids fell through the cracks because of technicalities. I scrub at my face, which is itching like crazy from the combination of old makeup, chlorine, and hospital.
Do you happen to know if the warrant for who had access to each CPS file has been finalized?
I believe so. I know Lee has been working on things. He and Gloria had their heads together.
That does not fill me with confidence.
Vic and Sterling come in not much later, laden down with coffees and tinfoil-wrapped plates of baked goods, courtesy of Marlene, staying up all night worrying about us. Sterling pads up behind Edison, but rather than trying to spook him like she normally does, she lays a hand against the back of his neck and holds up a large travel mug of coffee. He still flinches at the unexpected touch, but it's smaller, more contained, and he leans into her side, mumbling a thank you. Vic carefully lowers himself into a chair across from us, leaning forward so he can keep his volume low.
"Simpkins called the section chief to bitch about your being here," he tells us. "He checked in with Detective Holmes before calling me, and we're going to pretend I'm not sharing this, but you should have the heads up."
"Así que esto va bien entonces," Edison mutters.
"Her team will still be working the case, but she won't be. He's pulling her up on administrative review." We both blink at him, then look at Sterling, who settles in next to Vic and shrugs. We look back at Vic.
"Did Cass tell you anything about their case a couple weeks ago in Idaho?"
I shake my head.
"She said it was a clusterfuck, but we didn't get the chance to get drinks for the stitchin' bitch before this came up. At lunch on Wednesday, we were talking about this case."
"Simpkins rode the law enforcement officials so hard, they withdrew their request for aid before the case had been solved."
"In Idaho?" Sterling squeaks. "It's hard enough to get invited there."
"It should have gone to me as unit chief, but Simpkins took it over my head to the section chief. IA was reviewing the situation when the request from Holmes came in, but they hadn't reached a conclusion, and Gordon wanted the lead agent to have at least 20 years. It brings a weight to it that can go far in protecting the targeted agent."
"I've heard rumors that she put herself forward for your job," Edison notes.
I look down at my hands. I'm not going to throw Cass under the bus by confirming it. Vic grimaces.
"We don't know yet if that's connected," he cautions. "She hasn't been notified, so mouths shut. It'll be later today, once Gordon can get everything together."
"The Smiths have the most seniority," I note, "but neither of them is suited to leading a team. Cass is a great agent, but she doesn't have the leadership experience, not for a case like this. And Johnson is still transitioning back from medical leave, so he's desk-bound. That leaves who? Watts and Burnside?"
He's asking Watts. "Burnside is the best on the team at tracking through digital trails, so they want him focused on the CPS office."
"Watts is good," Edison says, more to me than to the others. "She's steady."
"Simpkins was, too." Sterling brings her legs up onto the chair, sitting cross-legged with a napkin across her lap to catch the crumbs from the croissant she's picking apart. She's frowning a little. This is her deep-in-thought frown, one of the distinctive ones, marked by her mouth twisting into a sideways moo. I watch her for several minutes, the frown shifting minutely as she works her way through the set of thoughts. Then Edison throws a blueberry at her from his muffin, and she looks up with wide, startled eyes.
"Share with the class, Thumper," he says.
"What if it isn't anything nice?" she retorts automatically. "Two kids died this morning, and a family of five became a family of one very broken little boy," I say softly. "I don't think there's any nice right now." She takes a deep breath and lets Vic pull the mangled pastry from her hands.
"The killer was too late to save the kids," she says in a rush. "It's possible that the stress of the so-called rescue exacerbated the effects of the drugs on their systems. So, she didn't save the kids. Add that to the fact that she's already accelerating the kills. And what happens next?"
"She needs to save these kids,"
Edison scowls down at what's left of his muffin.
Whatever's driving her, whatever personal trauma is nipping at her heels, doing this is a need. Failure will either drive that violence inward or outward, exploding in a frenzy, I finish.
She's not even trying your house anymore, Vic notes. Sterling checked your cameras. Only two cars came through that didn't belong to residents, and they went to homes and stayed there all night. Are still there, in fact.
But she's still giving them my name. Why?
How far did you get into your cases yesterday?
Thursday? Not far. Assessing and running every name takes time.
Can you make a rubric to narrow them down so we can help you sort through? You can dismiss cases where the victims were boys.
We can't, actually, Sterling interrupts with a wince. He could have a sister, a cousin, a neighbor, a friend, some girl who was influenced by Mercedes helping with the rescue. We give bears to all the kids, not just the immediate victims.
And we haven't eliminated the possibility of the killer being male, adds Edison. Plenty of men have higher-pitched voices or can fake it. Given popular depictions of angels, the wig may not even be out of place. We don't know gender. It's just easier to say she, because that's what the kids assume.
Despite our instincts screaming otherwise, he's right. And we can't rely on cases where I felt a particular connection with someone, because they're not always mutual. I could have had a drastic impact on someone's life and have absolutely no idea.
Shit, sighs Vic,
and we all flinch. He so rarely swears. I think we've all grown to think of him cursing as a sign that things are really fucked. Cass clears her throat from the hallway, getting our attention before she joins us.
I thought you'd want to know. CPS contacted both sets of Braden's grandparents. Paternals live in Alabama, maternals in Washington State, and both have indicated they want custody. They also really don't like each other. It could get nasty.
I sigh. Cass, one of these days, you're going to remember the difference between want to know and need to know. She gives me a tired smile.
The warrant went through. Mr. Lee should be getting me the list of file access by the end of business Monday. Burnside got approved for access to their system to examine digital footprints.
Word to the wise, Gloria Hess is helping Lee put the list together.
Fuck.
She glances at Vic and turns bright red, but doesn't apologize. His lips twitch in a reluctant smile.
Braden isn't talking to Tate, Cass continues after a moment. He isn't talking to anyone, but he doesn't seem to mind Tate staying with him.
Tate seems like very good people.
I got that impression, too.
She straightens out a wrinkle in her shirt, then frowns down at it.
I can't tell if this is inside out or backward.
Backward, Sterling answers. I can see the lines of the tag.
Huh. Anyway, Braden isn't going to communicate for a while. Tate said, and Holmes agrees, you should probably head home and get some rest. You know, if you want.
I eye the last splashes of my coffee and wonder if I can fall asleep before the caffeine kicks in.
Thank you, Cass, Vic says for all of us. You'll keep us updated.
Yes, sir.
Edison and I both snort, followed by Cass's blush deepening. Sterling just gives her a commiserating look. Cass, killer left bruises on Zoe's left wrist. I don't know if you'll be able to get fingerprints, but it can probably tell you her general size. Talk to Holmes and her medical examiner.
We end up following Vic home and sacking out in his living room rather than separating. Sterling curls up in the armchair, face buried in her knees. Edison and I each take a couch, and it says a lot that despite the adrenaline, the caffeine, the light pouring in through the sheer drapes, we're out cold pretty damn fast. Several hours later, the ringing of my personal phone snaps me awake in nothing flat, my heart thumping painfully against my ribs. Sterling wakes up just as abruptly, flailing off the chair and landing on the floor with a squeak that has Edison attempting to prop himself up on an elbow and sort of managing it three attempts later. The screen says Esperanza. "It's not another kid," I announce, and Edison drops back into the couch and blanket.
"You're not answering it," mumbles Sterling, hauling herself up the chair.
"I'm not sure if it's my cousin or my aunt."
"Are either of them bad options?"
"One of them is."
"Oh."
Edison cracks open one eye.
"Why is it still ringing?"
"Because I don't want to pick up if it's Soledad." I wait for it to go to voicemail and listen to the message. It's Esperanza, afortunadamente, but her message doesn't really tell me much. "There's something big. Call me back so I can be the one to tell you, rather than my mother." Big or little, I really don't want to know. Don't need to know. Before I can decide whether or not to call her back, the phone starts vibrating and ringing again, her name lighting up the screen. Damn it. With a bone-deep sigh, I accept the call. "Hello?" Sterling winces at how rough my voice is.
"Mercedes, it's afternoon where you are. Why do you sound like you just woke up?"
My cousin's voice is frazzled, which is uncommon for Esperanza. The biggest reason I allowed the reconnection was her calm and common sense.
"We were up all night for a case."
"What's wrong?"
"Family meeting this morning."
"Oh, God. I do not need to know this."
"Yes, you do. Theo is sick."
"Which Theo?"
There's a heavy silence, and after far too long, it clicks.
"Oh.
My father."
"Pancreatic cancer," she continues, "once it's clear I won't."
"Painful."
"The family wants to get him out of prison for treatment."
"Probably not happening, but not any of my business, regardless."
Edison is almost sitting up now, slumped against the arm of the couch and desperately blinking to keep his eyes from staying closed.
"Mercedes!"
Esperanza huffs into the microphone, and it distorts like a hurricane through my speaker.
"You really think the rest of the family isn't going to bother you about this?"
That's exactly what I think, because I'll be turning off my personal phone until I can switch the number.
"Most of the grandkids have never even met him."
"Lucky them."
"Mercedes!"
"No."
"Pancreatic cancer isn't all that treatable. You know he's probably dying."
"Mucho carne pa'l gato."
"Mercedes! Is that her?"
I hear her mother in the background.
"Let me speak to her, that ungrateful, malicious—"
I end the call and turn the phone off, which is how it will stay for a while. The kids in the hospital have my work number, as do Priya, Inara, and Victoria Bliss. Anyone else can email me. Have to admit, I'm disappointed in Esperanza. She was supposed to be the one person in the extended Ramirez familia who understood that wasn't my life anymore.
"Throw it against the wall," mumbles Edison.
"I have some pictures and shit to get off it first. Then we can destroy it."
"Okay."
You okay?
No. Go back to sleep, though. This problem isn't going anywhere. He immediately burrows back into his blanket, so only his shaggy dark curls are visible. Sterling regards me solemnly, and it's amazing how young she looks when her hair is down and messy around her face.
Need to talk about it?
She offers quietly. Sterling doesn't know the story the way Vic and Edison do, like her old boss Finney does, for that matter. It took me years and a half a bottle of tequila to finally tell Edison. But Sterling is... she's important, and I've finally settled into trusting that sense in a way I hadn't when I told Edison. She's my team, and she's my friend. She's my family. Not yet, I say eventually, when the world isn't on fire.
Sounds like a date.
She curls back into a tight ball, a little pill bug twisted into a tag-edged fleece blanket with Care Bears all over it. It is Brittany's favorite blanket in the world, and she very rarely lets it come downstairs for anyone else to use. As tired as I am, as drained, it still takes a long time to sleep again. My arms ache for the comfort of the black velvet teddy bear on my nightstand. But this case, I don't know if that bear will ever be what it was. It saved my life in important ways, or reminded me my life was worth living, however that distinction can be drawn. I stare at the ceiling for I don't even know how long, before Vic's face swims into blurry focus. His warm brown eyes look somewhere between sad and amused, and his calloused hand is gentle as he strokes my hair back from my face, thumb lingering over the scars. Sleep, Mercedes. You're not alone. The laugh comes out more like a sob, but I close my eyes, and he lightly pets my hair until I fall asleep.
Once upon a time, there was a little girl who was scared of change. But some fears, she'd finally learned, were good things. Some fears weren't the terror and pain. They were just thrills, sparks of nerve. Despite the uncertainty of all of her foster homes, where impermanence was the only permanent thing, the little girl had worked hard at school, learning all the things her lackadaisical homeschooling had never taught her. She worked hard to catch up, and then she worked harder to get ahead. When it came time to apply for colleges, she had stellar grades and a fistful of personal essays that struck a carefully crafted balance between the horrific experiences of her past and a heartwarming determination for her future. Her guidance counselor, perhaps the only person the little girl tentatively labeled on her side, had laughed herself silly when she read them, promised her she'd strike gold with them. She had. She got acceptances and scholarships, and when combined with the money the court forced her father to give her nearly 4 years before, it meant she could even go out of state, start over somewhere entirely new. Somewhere no one knew what had happened to her, unless they worked in admissions. She even changed her name, legally and officially. It made the school paperwork a nightmare, but it was worth it. Her old name belonged to that other girl, that girl who'd been hurt by so many people and could never do anything to stop it. She was someone new, someone without the baggage and the accent, someone from nowhere and anywhere. There was nothing to tie her to where she'd come from. She loved college. It was scary and overwhelming and wonderful,
with freedoms she'd never dared dream of. She even made friends. Slowly, cautiously, not entirely honestly, but friends enough to make her genuinely happy for the first time she could remember. She didn't date. She wasn't brave enough for that. Wasn't sure she wanted to be. But her friends protected her when people didn't want to take no for an answer, when her old instincts fought against her new courage. And she was grateful. She found a job that didn't require her to interact with people much, and let her face some of her old fears in small ways. And she was surprised by how restful it was. She enjoyed her friends and classes, liked getting together with other people. But working gave her time alone to recover, to recenter. She liked the balance, and was proud of herself for discovering and maintaining it. Once upon a time, there was a little girl who was afraid of change. She went out bravely into the world anyway. 21. The events at the hospital and the Joneses' home happened too late to get into the Saturday paper, but they start spinning around on social media that afternoon, and half the front page on Sunday is dedicated to a tweaker tragedy. And I really want to stake whatever asshole came up with that headline. The only blessing to the relentlessly slipshod reporting is that none of the other murders are brought up. The article doesn't even classify the Joneses' death as suspicious. It makes it sound like the kids wandered away from home to get help, and their home exploded while they were gone. It lists the wrong fire station, totally misses the detectives who were present, and misidentifies the FBI as DEA agents. It's some form of protection for Braden, at least, and all the other kids. Priya pokes my shoulder at breakfast, which is eaten out in the living room because there's too many of us even for the seldom-used dining room. What time is Mass?
What?
Mass, she repeats patiently. What time? I blink at her, too tired to fully comprehend what she's asking. You feel better when you go to Mass, Mercedes. It's a Sunday. So what time?
She likes the 9:30 best, Edison tells her, around a mouthful of half-chewed apple tart.
Priya checks her watch and pushes to her feet.
We should get dressed, then.
Priya rarely chooses to take charge of things, but when she wants to, she's a lot like her mother. Impossible to resist. Before I'm fully aware of moving, my clothes are changed, and I'm sitting in the back seat with my makeup bag, and Priya holding a mirror steady, Sterling in the front passenger seat, as Edison drives us to church. It's a bizarre mix. Priya isn't a practicing Hindu, if that's the right description, but she does wear a bindi on a daily basis, and Sterling is Jewish, despite her deep and abiding love for bacon. Edison was raised Catholic, but his faith didn't survive his sister's kidnapping and so far permanent disappearance. He occasionally sits with me, usually at Christmas, or when I'm having a rough time. But the memories, so ingrained in him through his childhood, make him uncomfortable in churches. But there we all are, stretched out in a pew near the back, Priya and Sterling subtly watching others for their cues, and Edison blushing every time he's standing or sitting or kneeling by rote. When everyone else starts moving, pew by pew, for communion, Priya gives me a questioning look. I shake my head. You can't take communion without confession. And you can't do confession because of your job? Job isn't really a factor, as long as I don't share confidential information, I whisper. It's more that I can't receive absolution for sins
I don't genuinely repent.
She still looks confused, and despite everything, it makes me smile.
I don't think I...